Welcome back to the Surfacing Leaders Podcast, where you can come along with nuclear submarine officer, sought-after turnaround CEO, and founder of Lead with Purpose, Mark Kohler, as he tells the stories of leaders in unlikely places and the human spirit that drives us all to show us that anyone can learn to be a leader. And now, here's Mark Kohler.
Liz Wiseman is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Multipliers, and Wall Street Journal bestsellers, Rookie Smarts and Impact Players. She is a researcher and executive advisor who teaches leadership to executives around the world and the CEO of the Wiseman Group, a leadership research and development firm that's headquartered in Silicon Valley, California. Liz is a former executive at Oracle Corporation, where she worked as the vice president of Oracle University and as the global leader for human resource development. She's a frequent guest lecturer at Brigham Young University and Stanford University. Liz has received the Top Achievement Award for Leadership from Thinkers 50 and has consistently been named one of the world's top 50 management thinkers. Liz, welcome to the Surfacing Leaders Podcast.
Mark, it's good to be here. I look forward to the conversation.
Awesome. So let's start off. Tell us where you were born and why don't you take us to today?
I was born in Southern California in Whittier, California. And my parents are both native Californians, and we moved up north. I grew up in San Jose, and I've lived in California my whole life other than college, where I went to Brigham Young University and came back to the Bay Area, which is home, and have spent my career and adult life, raised our family here.
Yeah, awesome. So at Brigham Young, what did you study?
I was in the business school. And I studied finance as an undergraduate, and then I got a master's in organizational behavior, which is, I think, today a division of the MBA program.
Yeah.
MBA with like strategy and leadership or something to that effect.
Yeah. And around what year is this? Just to give it a framework.
Yeah. So I graduated with my master's in 1988.
Oh, wow. 1988. And then you moved back.
I'm trying to make sure I'm keeping the years right on this. Yeah, 1988. And I moved back, and I had done this internship while I was in graduate school for a company called Novell. And there were this like really fun, rapidly growing software company. And I was looking for a version of that back home in California. And, you know, I live sort of in the heart of Silicon Valley, was raised here in the heart of Silicon Valley. And so I was kind of looking for a really interesting, maverick, breaking all the rules kind of company. Ended up joining Oracle, which was a perfect place to, you know, learn a maverick culture. And
yeah,
was there for 17 years.
Yeah, that's awesome. How big was Oracle when you joined?
Not big, not what they are today.
There were
a couple thousand people. So it was, you know, a small to medium-sized software company. They had gone public 2 years before I joined. You know, it was still the size where you kind of knew everyone's name, or you felt like you knew everyone's name. My daughter right now works at Neuralink, which is the Elon Musk company. There's probably a few hundred people there. And the way she describes work is very much how Oracle felt in the early days, working for this sort of visionary maverick and just this collection of brilliant, interesting, driven people, like doing something. I think Neuralink was doing something more noble today. They're doing the neural implants to help address profound neurological diseases, paraplegia, et cetera. But it was like a bunch of just like incredibly smart, interesting people. And that was sort of this big and kind of all type A driven people as well. And so you can imagine like what happens when you put all those people, you know, into a building and sort of compress it. It's like frenetic energy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exciting. And, you know, it's easy to look back on now and say, well, Oracle made it. But I mean, it sounds, you know, that time, it was a tumultuous time, you know, the building out of the internet and everything that had to do with, you know, that period of time. It's a tremendous. We all, you know, like I said, we all look at Oracle now and go, oh, they, you know, yeah, look how big they are and everything they're established. And you go like, hey, a lot of them didn't make it.
Oh, Oracle almost didn't make it. In, you know, 1989, Oracle was on the verge of bankruptcy and, you know, almost not able to make payroll. And that's when Larry had to do, you know, some like deals to put together the kind of funding and keep the company going. But most of us didn't really understand how dire it was until we were in a really strong position. But that's the environment I learned to lead in. And it was both a really high growth environment where you just get thrown bigger and bigger jobs. And it's almost like anyone can kind of figure out how to lead in some ways because, you know, it's just all things are rising. And then, you know, I had some chances to go through periods of contraction and, you know, layoffs and difficult situations and globalization. And, you know, you learn to lead in downtimes. And I think haven't done both. You don't have a well-rounded leadership skill set if you haven't had to deal with some pretty tough times as well.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. It's easy to be a great leader when everything's going great. Mm-hmm. And then how do you get through the tough times? Now, when you went to Oracle, take us through a couple of the jobs you had. One of the things that was really interesting for me when I was looking at your background was this development of a university with inside of Oracle. And can you talk us through that? And because I think it's a really important aspect that Oracle was in on very, very early. It's just something that we're really pushing all of our clients to look at is some type of internal university. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that shows up in each one of my books. There's like some little vignette or story about that because it's probably part of my career trauma, you know, is being tasked with that. And, you know, again, Oracle's growing really rapidly, gobbling up talent. You know, Larry's idea was to build this relational database management system, and it was this new technology. No one had done it. And what that meant is no one knew how to do it. So you couldn't grow the company by hiring a bunch of people who had deep technical expertise in relational database management because it was a white paper. Like the concept started as a white paper out of IBM. And Larry's like, you know what? I'm gonna go build that and commercialize that. And so there is this deep need to build like expertise. And so, you know, we had new hire training and such, but, you know, Larry had this vision if he wanted to build a corporate university. And, you know, this was sort of the early days of corporate university.
Right.
And I was working in our group that did new hire training and they wanted to go build a university. And I was part of that and got tasked to go do that. And, you know, honestly, I had no idea how to do this. And, you know, I remember one of my, you know, it was comical at the time. It's like, okay, well, a university, we got to start building a curriculum, but we also need like every university has like a crest and a motto, and the motto needs to be in Latin. So we kind of put our heads together and we're like, knowledge is power, you know? And so I had a graphic artist put us together this like OU kind of look like, you know, Oklahoma University, OU. I think I have the shirt somewhere in one of these cabinets. And I'm like, okay, we need a Latin, you know, motto, knowledge is power. That sounds like, I don't know, like you bang your chest to that. It just sounded right. And I'm like, yeah, but that needs to be in Latin. And I'm like, well, I don't know Latin. And I don't know anyone in the, you know, within arm's reach who knew Latin. And this is way before the internet. You could just Google stuff. And so I did what I thought was totally reasonable. I just call up Stanford because, you know, it's like a mile away or it's a mile from my house. But, you know, we're maybe 5 miles away from the campus. So I call up the main switch. I'm like, can you connect me to the classics department? They connect me. I'm like, could you connect me to a professor like of Latin? And I just got to the president. I'm like, hi, you don't know me, but starting this university. Would you mind just translating for me? Knowledge is power. And he was, I think, so shocked that I just called him that. He was like, oh, I'd be happy to do this. Apparently, as Valeri, like, to know is to have value. And I'm like, great, thanks. I call up the artist. I'm like, printed on the shirt, knowledge, sapere est valere. And it was, we had no idea what we were doing. But, you know, it's one of those things where you get thrust into a leadership role and you just figure it out. And, you know, Mark, given like the work you do, you understand, like some people aspire to be leaders, like study leadership, read leadership books, and they get on this path of leadership and it's planned. And then there are those of us who live what David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, called the summoned life, which is you just happen to step onto a problem or an opportunity or a situation that needs some leadership. And you happen to be in the right place at the right time and you just say yes and you find yourself leading. And this was very much my path, which, you know, I didn't have a big plan for career. I knew I wanted to work with really smart, interesting people and do something smart and interesting. But that was probably one of my first big opportunities to really lead something and build a team. And I remember like my boss saying, you know what, we've got to make this work all around the world. So like get on an airplane and go to Europe. And so, you know, I go do a tour of Europe. Okay, how do we make this university work here and there? And I didn't even have a passport before this trip. And, you know, and you just, you're out there and you're just figuring it out, making it work and learning as you go. And
I love that. I mean, just the ability to say yes to the next, you know, challenge that's ahead of you. And where do you think that was seed was placed in you? Where did that come from?
Well, I've been told a time or two in my youth and maybe early adulthood that I'm a touch naive. And, you know, and I think it's I call this the naive yes, and it's saying, and it's not naively saying yes to everything. It's not letting other people own your agenda. It's saying yes to things that are hard and new and scary. It's just saying yes before your brain kicks in and tells you you can't do this thing. So it's the dumb yes. And I've been doing this my whole life. You know, I don't know where that came from, other than, you know, maybe a healthy dose of passive parenting, which is kind of how parenting was in the 70s, you know, when I was growing up. And, you know, I certainly didn't have parents who neglected me, but I didn't have parents who did things for me. And, you know, I started work at 13 and worked to my dad's donut shop and have had a job ever since then and had to put myself through college. And so you just find a way to make those things work. And, you know, I'm sure my parents helped me a lot more than I remember, but I don't remember my parents like sitting down with me and helping me figure out college applications and where I was going to go to school and what I was going to write about in the essay. Like, I think maybe I remember my mom giving me a stamp, you know, to put on there. And I had very like a loving, supportive home, but you just had to do a lot for yourself. And so I think you just do things because they need to be done, not because you decide you're ready to do them.
Yeah, I think that's so important today, what you're talking about. And as the listeners are sitting here, you know, it's a combination of naivete. It's a combination of grit. And it's probably a combination of taking small steps and then building confidence as you go through each one of those steps of, hey, I'm just taking the next step and then figuring it out along the way. And I just believe that's so needed today to be able to just take a next step and make a decision, knowing that your next step's not your final step, and just figure it out along the way.
Yeah. And Paul, on confidence, you know, I've always been fairly confident. I think, you know, anyone who knows me would say that I probably have more confidence than capability. Not that I'm necessarily lacking in capability, but my confidence has probably always out-edged my capability by a notch or two. And I don't I don't know that that was like a birth gift. Maybe it was. Maybe it was like a spiritual gift that, you know, I was given through life. I really believe we all come with a set of sort of innate spiritual gifts. And maybe that was one of mine. But confidence gets built in layers. And it's like noticing, I did this thing and it worked. And so you're building efficacy throughout your life. And yeah. And so when you get to the hard stuff, you know, like, oh, I've done things outside of my knowledge zone. I've done things outside of my comfort zone.
Yeah. Just love that. Love it. Love it. Let's go back to you getting the Latin version of your code word. And, you know, I can imagine, you know, you get the Latin version, you put it on a shirt and you're like, hey, we're done.
We're good. University check.
Everything's going to just fall into place. There's a lot of companies, you know, as an example is, you know, I went into the nuclear submarine force. I didn't know diddly about nuclear power. And, you know, they gave me, quote unquote, a master's in 6 months in nuclear engineering, which is, you know, typically takes 18 months to do. And so they were teaching us really, they wanted to get us to the fleet as fast as possible, but they were teaching us how to learn. That was the most important thing that they were teaching us before we even got to the submarine. And so, you know, I think the military has done a great job in having a ladder of expectations and having a ladder of education that's really laid out. And as we take a look at today, you were early in on it, you know, just trying to figure it out. And a lot of companies are going like, hey, how do I figure out this university thing?
Yeah.
And you were early in on it. But I think there's a lot that, you know, can be learned about, hey, the shortage that we have for workers. You know, hey, it's how do you hire for values and start training for skill? And certainly you're not going to hire, you know, an accountant to be a doctor. But what are some of the things that you can take a look at and then, you know, hire people and then train them for the skills with some type of university or accessing something that helps to develop them? So I'd love to get your thoughts on that as people are thinking about that right now. Hey, how do I dive into this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple ways to approach corporate learning. And one is the skills framework. And, you know, honestly, that's where we were back in, you know, 1990 when we were doing this I remember, you know, like mapping out like the skill matrix, which is like, okay, right. Here are all the skills we need. You know, we've got a new product dropping. We need people who can install it, tune it, troubleshoot this, sell it, you know, build demos based on it. And so we had these massive, massive, like, here are all our jobs and here's the skills and who needs what and where they are. And I remember these late nights, you know, like building out these models, trying to figure out how do we resource this and deploy the training where we need and get the right instructors. And that is one way to do it. I did this back in the early, you know, to mid to then, you know, late 90s, and we could get our arms around it, but just barely. You know, like, it's a pretty big spreadsheet that you have to build to figure out how do you make sure your workforce is fully skilled. I don't know that I could do that job today. I don't know that that approach works that well today because it's too big. And I did a little bit of research for a book I wrote called Rookie Smarts. But, you know, when you look at how knowledge, you know, new knowledge is being generated, and you look at the pace at which information becomes outdated, knowledge becomes antiquated, like that, it doesn't work that way anymore, which if you have teenage or young adult children, you know that because they're constantly telling you, like, Dad, the world doesn't work that way anymore. Like, that's not how you do things. So when you look at knowledge and information explosion and, you know, the how fast it gets outdated, you know, what you know today, only about 15% of it is going to be relevant in 5 years. And I did that calculation several years ago. I think that number is even smaller. That's not 50% of what we know. It's 1/5, which means that, you know, our knowledge and skills is getting antiquated really fast. So I don't know that the skill competency matrix approach is how the best universities work anymore. I think the best corporate universities are going to work a lot more like higher education, which is the content of what you're learning is not what's important. It's the process of learning. And again, if you've got, you know, Mark, you, I know you've raised daughters.
Three.
You know, I remember like my kids coming to me in high school and sort of bemoaning the fact that they were learning, I don't know, organic chemistry or multivariable calculus or something. And they were sort of on to the dirty secret of even high school learning is that you're probably not going to use that much in life. You know, I took a lot of math in college. And I tell you, I don't use anything other than basic arithmetic and some statistical analysis. And maybe I do a tiny bit of algebra every now and then. Like most of that, you don't know. And so they would say like, oh, I'm having to memorize like the capitals of this and this. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. You will never, ever in your life need to know all of the capitals of Europe. You know, you are not going to need to use like multivariable calculus, most likely, unless you're going to be like, I don't know, a nuclear submarine engineer. Like the chances of you using this knowledge are so slim. However, what you will need over and over and over in life is the ability to be presented with a new subject, yes, master it fast, solve the problem, give a presentation, finish the project, dispose of that knowledge. Like, let it go and move on to the next thing. That you're going to do thousands and thousands of time in your life and in your professional life. And that's what you're learning. You're learning the ability to absorb, solve problems, apply it, work in a group, cram information into your head, give the presentation, and move on. And so I think, like, a corporate university today is probably more about the process of learning and like, where do you find the tools and how do you absorb? And it's about access, I think, more than skills matrices.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. The churn of the knowledge can churn. But, you know, when we take a look at corporate university too, or universities, what are the human skills that you need? Which
those don't change much.
Those don't change. And so I'd love to now get into, you know, your inspiration for your book, Multipliers. What was the inspiration behind it? And then could you describe for us what a multiplier is?
Mm-hmm. Well, Multipliers was probably my post-Oracle therapy. It was in some ways me trying it was certainly more than like a journal entry. It wasn't that I'm just trying to work things out in my mind on paper. It was me coming off of almost 2 decades of a really intense experience. And it was working around really smart people. And it was, for me, it was joining Oracle back in the day where like the people they hired were absolutely brilliant. So these were the top graduates out of the top technical programs in the top universities. So these are the top of the class of MIT and Caltech and Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard and, you know, Carnegie Mellon and all of these schools. And I was just enamored with all of these smart people I worked with. And I felt really lucky to work there. And it was for almost 2 decades, I'm watching all these smart people and how their career is progressing. And I'm watching these brilliant people get put into management positions. And I'm watching how some of them are sucking the life out of the team around them. And I'm like, you know, they're smart, but nobody around them gets to be smart. Like, they have to be the centerpiece of the capability of the team. And I also watched, you know, other leaders equally brilliant have a very different kind of effect. They, you know, they weren't, and they weren't weaponizing their intelligence as many of what I call these diminishing leaders were. They were leaders who used their intelligence as a tool. And, you know, in many ways, I guess, to pursue this metaphor of like, they weren't the centerpiece. They were setting the table for other people to come, and they create these kind of like feasts of smarts and intelligence and creativity and innovation. And I came to call these leaders multipliers. And it wasn't until I left Oracle and I started doing some executive coaching work. And, you know, I'm coaching a lot of tech executives here in Silicon Valley. And there was one in particular, just absolutely brilliant. But, you know, people around him were suffering, you know, struggling to speak up. And, he, you know, and I was explaining to him this observation I had from my days at Oracle that, you know, a leader's intelligence and capability and their talent can either have an amplifying effect on the team, or it can have a diminishing effect on the team. And it was clicking for him. And I was looking for some, then I went after our meeting to go look for some research to substantiate what I had observed for years. And turned out no one had really looked into this. No research had been done. And that was another naive yes. And I had, in the process of running the university, I had hired a lot of professors. Many of the world's renowned professors were sort of colleagues of mine. And so, you know, I knew a lot about their research and how they did their research. Jim Collins and Clay Christensen and C.K. Prahalad and, you know, all of these business scholars, they were all friends at this point. And I figured they could do it. I could do it. You know, it didn't seem that hard.
Another naive yes.
It was another naive yes. And so I'm I'll go do that research. And turned out it found some really interesting things. So I thought, oh, I should probably write this up. And, you know, there was an opportunity to write a book and got a book contract and signed the contract going, wow, I've never written a book before. I better figure out how to do that, you know. So that was another naive yes.
Yeah, I think that's great. When you talk about the multipliers versus the diminishers, what are the key traits, someone listening right now, what are the key traits that represent a multiplier or distinguish a multiplier from a diminisher?
Well, there's probably three things people should know about this idea. One is what they do differently. And there are five things that they do differently. The first is how they manage talent. You know, diminishers tend to be empire builders. They hire really smart people. And multipliers tend to be talent magnets. Smart people flock to work for them because they don't just see people as a collection of skills. They, you know, or an IQ score or an SAT score or GPA. They look at people's natural or native genius and they figure out, what is this person really good at? Like, Liz Wiseman's working for me. You know what? This gal is really good at the naive yes. We're just going to give her a bunch of hard stuff and like...
Put her in those positions, just right? Yeah.
Put her in positions where she doesn't know what she's doing. She tends to be at her best there. I think a bunch of people figured that out about me. The second is the kind of work environment they create. And diminishers tend to be tyrants. They create an environment that is stressful, that is tense, which causes people... thinking to shut down versus the multiplier that is more like a liberator. They create an environment of safety. They give people space. But in exchange for that space, they really expect people's best thinking and best work. The third difference is how they set direction. The diminisher tends to be a know-it-all. They set direction based on what they know, what they see, so they operate in directives. They tell people what to do. And the multiplier, they're challengers. They invite people to explore possibilities. They issue invitations. They ask questions rather than give answers. And the fourth difference is how they make decisions. The diminisher tends to be the decision maker and often make good decisions, but leave people confused about the decisions. Like, why are we doing this? Did someone bring up this? Did we explore that? Do they know about this? Whereas the multiplier tends to be the debate maker. They don't necessarily turn the decision over to the group, but they, on all the important decisions, they have a debate before making that decision, which surfaces the issues. It builds consensus. It builds like capability. It builds deep understanding. So decisions get implemented quickly. And then the last is how they get things done. Diminishers tend to be micromanagers, whereas the multipliers tend to be investors. They give other people ownership over parts of the decision or business or function or work. And You know, they give people the accountability that comes with that. And those are what they really do differently. That's kind of the first thing to know. The second thing to know is that these diminishing leaders are getting less than half of people's available intelligence, whereas multipliers get almost all. It's a 2x difference.
Wow.
And then maybe the last and most important thing to know is not just what they do differently and how it affects people, but to know that most of the diminishing that's being done is in our workplaces is accidental. And this is like well over 2/3 of it is being done with really good intentions, good people trying to be good bosses, you know, that tune into leadership podcasts, who are on leadership podcasts, you know, people who are really trying to be good leaders, but are having in many ways a very deeply diminishing effect.
Interesting, because that's what we're seeing too, is that the intent is right. We think that, you know, a lot of leaders that we run into, we think that we are serving others by always having the answer, by having to make the decision. And I think, Liz, just our you know, thought on that is because that's how we were brought up. You know, that's what, you know, the leader had the answer every single time. And the leader is the one you could go to. And there was this expectation when you become a leader that I have to have all the answers. And so it's interesting you said about 2/3 of it, because I think we really do want, you know, people have really good intent. They just don't know the challenge that they're causing inside the organization, especially now. You know, when the speed of business was slower, it was easier for me to be involved in the different decisions. Now it's like speed of business is so fast and I can't work another hour. Mm. I'm burning myself out. So is that what you're seeing also?
Yeah. And it is, it's diminishing done with good intent, thinking I'm serving the team. I'm answering people's questions. I'm being helpful. I'm being positive. I'm being protective. I'm being enthusiastic. I'm being energetic. And it's almost like we think our behavior is infectious. Like the boss is jazzed up. So therefore, the team will be jazzed up. And in many ways, like when the boss gives so much energy and enthusiasm, it sucks it from the team. Or when we're really helpful with the best of intentions, people don't have to figure it out themselves. They don't have to learn from the consequences of their decision. And like the boss is absorbing so much of it. And it's hard to see, because it's hard to see through our good intentions.
Right.
You know, there's so much, you know, evidence on this. Tasha Urich's book, Insight, does a really good job of showing how hard it is for leaders to really see their impact on others. Like it's really hard to be self-aware as a leader. But what I see is that in many ways, when we do something kind of jerk-like, it's kind of easy to see. You're like, oh man, I totally shut that person down. Wow, I kind of ripped that person. I shouldn't have been hard on that. Like we kind of know there's a thing inside us that feels some guilt or something. And we're like, yeah, I was kind of a bad boss. But when we do something with the best of intentions, we often don't feel that pang of guilt, of like remorse for, I don't know, doing something harsh. And so nobody tells us, you know, you step in and rescue people in the 11th hour rather than make them fight that out and figure it out themselves. You know, you get a pat on the back like, hey, thanks. But, you know, you don't see that inside they're crumbling or inside they're like, I've got to go find a job where I actually get to do some of the hard, interesting work rather than just tee things up for my boss.
Yeah. And we were talking about leadership. Hey, it's easy to be a leader when all, you know, when the tide is rising. But, you know, we deny people the ability to learn. And it's not to give people a struggle to give people a struggle, but we really deny people the ability to learn and to grow when we just always jump in and solve the problem. And I always say, Liz, how old are your kids right now?
20 to 29.
Yeah. And so anybody who's listening right now, if you've ever taught your kid how to how to drive a car. I mean, if every single time that you are driving the car and you're in the passenger seat, every single time you take the wheel, there's going to be a time where the driver just takes their hands off the wheel and goes, hey, you know, someone else is going to take that. Obviously not get in a crash, but, you know, are there things that you
Mark,
can ask questions like...
Mark, did you actually grab the steering wheel when your daughters were learning to drive?
There's only... I never grabbed the steering wheel. There was only one time...
Because I'm thinking there's a fun story behind this.
Yes. So there's one time where my third daughter, you know, I always would ask a question. Like I'd look like 100 yards up the road and there'd be a trash truck on the side of the road and say, hey, what do you see anything up above, you know, up ahead? They go, yeah, I see a trash truck. And they, so is there anything you think you might want to do? Yeah, I should maybe move into the left-hand lane. There was one where I was asking questions. Hey, what does it look like up there? It's a red light. And she didn't see it. I pulled the emergency brake. So that's only one time that I did that. So, yeah.
And you know what? I love your story. It's such a good metaphor because, you know, I spent a fair bit of time teaching leaders how to be good multipliers. So they're going to be like asking good questions and giving other people space, which is what you're doing, which is, hey, what do you see? What do you think you might want to do? Okay, you know, how far away is the off-ramp? When should you start slowing down? Like you're guiding someone through that process. But there are times where you do need to pull the emergency brake. And
yeah.
And they aren't many, but there are times where as a leader, you know, you're not going to multiply people through this situation.
Right.
You're like, you know what? We have a life or a death situation. We're just going to like, pull this right now.
Yeah. And our listeners probably know this, just for you to know, on a U.S. nuclear submarine, the percentage of decisions that a captain's involved in on a daily basis is less than 1%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just because even though I remember the submarine going at a 40 degree down angle, it all had flanked to the bottom of the ocean when we had a stern planes drill that we were running, and the captain just looked at me and said, Mr. Kohler, what are you going to do? And in my mind, I was lost because it was so stressful. My mind had blanked about actually what I was supposed to say. And he kept asking me every 100 feet, Mr. Kohler, what are you going to do? And then finally he said, you know, this is the captain. I have the con. He said, jam dive. And those were the two words that I was searching for. And, you know, he taught me a really powerful lesson that day that, hey, it's great to be a great decision maker, but we have a watch section around you. You need to tap in your watch section and ask them a question. Hey, I need a recommendation here. And he said, someone would have said the stern planes are stuck in a jam dive position. They would have known that I was stuck. They would have served me. Then I would have said jam dive and the whole situation. So that was powerful because he said to me, you have to understand, Mr. Kohler, that the submarine, the success or failure of it is not based upon one person.
Yeah.
And it's such a powerful metaphor for today.
You know, Mark, that reminds me of two things. One is, you know, when I look back on my experience with Oracle, it was like, I just got asked to do really big, hard things that I didn't know how to do. And like, I just had to figure it out. And I remember thinking, yeah, if I don't do this, there is no one else around who's going to do this for me. In a young, growing company, it wasn't like you have a ton of redundancy. And I was reflecting on that with someone who was one of the vice president when I was in some of these early jobs. And I was telling him about it. And he's like, oh, Bob Shaver, he's like, oh, Liz, we had a safety net under you. Like, we weren't going to let you fail. And I'm like, I didn't see the safety net.
Right.
Like, nobody briefed me on the safety net. And like, I think he looked at me like, well, of course, we're not going to really tell you about the safety net. Because then you might like not use it, or you might use it too early. And he's like, but no, we were not going to let you fail. There was like a net of like leaders and managers around you who were going to help you if you struggled. The other thing it makes me think of, you mentioned that 1% of the time, I had this powerful experience. It started when I was teaching multipliers. It started when I was at the Yale Medical School and I was teaching a group of physician leaders at the Yale New Haven Hospital. And so these are the people that run, you know, the various departments, you know, with all the residents and, you know, so emergency. And we've got this one day leadership workshop and it's on multipliers. And I was actually a little reluctant to go out there because I'm like, I know doctors, my best friends are doctors. And when I'm writing this book, they're like, oh, Liz, doctors are trained to be diminishers. And so I'm worried about this session, but I go out there and the whole morning is so interesting and they're all just amazing, you know, physician leaders, and we're having a great time. And then we break for lunch, they come back and there's like a mutiny in the room because they said, you know, like, we want to be multipliers. We get it. We want to like ask questions and hold debates and look for people's like natural genius. Like, that all sounds great. But like, Liz, we're not sure you know what we do. Like, we deal with life and death situations. Like, when somebody is flatlining in OR, this is not a multiplier moment. Like, we yell and we scream at people. And so I pause and, of course, you know, I'm thinking of one of my children on the operating table. Like, what would I want them to do? And I asked them, I said, what percentage of your time are you dealing with these life and death moments? And they took that question seriously and they conferred amongst themselves. And they're like, probably 3 to 5% of our time. I'm like, well, in the 3 to 5% of your time, I recommend you tell, you yell. Like, of course, you're not debating, like, you know, yell, like, clamp, you know, like, no, not that, you know, you do what you need to save the life. But how do you need to lead in the other 95 to 97% of your time? And like, what happens if you lead like a multiplier there in those 95 to 90% moments? Like, not only you've built capability and competence and intelligence and know-how so that when you yell at people, A, they know what to do. Their brain doesn't shut down and they trust you. They're not like, what a jerk. They're like, you know what? I'm just going to do whatever she tells me to do right now. Done. And then it was like a month or two later, I was out at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey and I was teaching a multiplier session there. And the same mutiny happened. It just happened a little bit sooner with the, and these were all, you know.
Did they call the doctors?
They hadn't conferred to my knowledge, but okay. These are people who were like the commanding officers, the executive officers, whatever, of like the big warship kind of thing. So these are people who run these ships that are like small villages, you know this, and world. And they had the same pushback midway through our time together. And I asked them and they said, probably 2 to 3% of our time. And that's what I think can be confusing because, yes, there are moments where you pull the emergency brake and you just say, you know what, override here. Like, I can't guide you through this. This is not like, this is a different kind of a teaching moment. I'm going to take over. But it's a small percentage. And that was for like doctors and ship commanders.
Yes. Yes. So key was the other part of the story. When we were doing that, and the captain took over control. As the submarine was coming back up to 400 feet, he has a conversation with me. He tells me, hey, submarine's not dependent upon one person. We go back around to the front of the control room where we're with the watch section again. And he looks at me and he says, Mr. Kohler, are you ready to take back control of the con? And I remember looking at him going like, I almost just scuttled a $1 billion submarine and put the lives of 110 people at risk, and you're going to give me control back? And that's what I was saying inside. But because he asked me, I knew he believed in me. Guess what we did? 400 feet below the surface of the ocean, we're going all ahead flank again, and the drill monitor takes the stern planes and puts them all the way into the jam dive position. I say jam dive to redeem myself and to redeem myself in front of the watch section. And that was such a powerful lesson for me because during those—
He gave you a redo.
Yeah, I said, we're going to do it over again. Even though you know the answer right now, we're going to put you in that stressful situation again so that you will never, ever forget this. And took the time to do that. Now, we didn't have a lot to do sometimes. We were training, but he took the time to do that. It would have been easier just to say, hey, next up, you know, next person up on the, right? So that was just a powerful experience for me. And with the doctors, I know they have to run to the next emergency, but it's always then afterwards, hey, let's unpack that situation that happened. And then go through that situation again. And as leaders, we need to have time to do that. And a lot of time we don't. So.
Well, and it's also just really brilliant, like neurological coaching and conditioning, because leaving someone on a failure, like, is now creating an imprint with them, which is like, I failed at that. But what that commander did was allowed you to like create the neuroprogramming, which is, no, I didn't fail at that. I succeeded at that. And so you're left with a success. So it's this confidence building thing, and you've got the like little bits of muscle memory to do it right. And so it's really, really brilliant leadership.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So Multipliers, I thought it was a fantastic book, written in, was it 2011 or 10? I can't remember.
Originally in 2010, and then I did a pretty significant revision to it in 2017.
What were the changes to it?
Well, I did a little bit of reframing of the concept, and it really reflected what I had learned. When I wrote the book, I really wrote it like there are leaders who are multipliers and diminishers. And I think in the ensuing years, what I learned to see is everyone's got diminishing tendencies. Like, I think for a lot of us, there is a diminisher lurking just, you know, a few hundred feet below the surface, so to speak. Like, and it's more about, it was that moment, a multiplier moment or a diminishing moment. And so I did a little bit of reframing around that, but and I updated a few stories, but what I really did was add 2.5 new chapters. That was the bulk of it. So I added a chapter on the accidental diminisher and the ways that that shows up, some like 9 accidental diminisher tendencies that bait us into this positive intent but diminishing effect. I added a chapter called Dealing with Diminishers because, you know, I think I started a little bit naively. This is kind of that part of me that can be a little bit naive with this idea that we could like eradicate diminishing from the workplace. And, you know, the truth is you're going to have diminishing leaders wherever you go. And, you know, instead of like quitting your job or, you know, sitting and sulking, there are a lot of strategies for how you can effectively deal with and minimize and even like thwart diminishing leadership. And I personally have a fair bit of experience with that. I think I hate diminishing so much that like you should hire me, Mark, just and try to diminish me and watch what happens. It's not going to be good for you. No, I think I've got like a really healthy defense system against diminishing. And then I added a lot more on how do you really build a multiplier culture? How do you create an environment where it's a shared ethos and it becomes a norm rather than an exception?
Love that. Just love that as it relates to your own ability to continue to evolve. And I think that's such an important part of everyone's journey and everyone's leadership journey that we're all on. So make the update 2017, and then you come out with this fantastic book called Impact Players. What was the genesis behind wanting to write Impact Players?
Well, I think I had spent a decade looking at what leaders do to create an environment where people can, I guess, in shorthand, play big. You know, and that's what I was originally fascinated with is there's like, I worked for a company that hired brilliant people, but then a lot of managers underutilize them. And like, why do some people get to play big and others have to play small because of their boss? And then as I looked at like, here's what the leader needs to do to create this environment where people can be deeply utilized and contributing fully, I began to see that there's a whole other side to this. Like the way the leader shows up is one variable in this equation, but so is the way the contributor shows up. And, you know, what are the mindsets and practices that we need to bring as talent and as contributors to be able to play at our best. And, you know, and maybe that it came into focus for me when I was off teaching a multipliers workshop up in San Francisco. I think it was Salesforce. And one of the participants said, yeah. I want to be a multiplier leader, but you can't multiply zero. And I started to think about that. And I was originally, I thought, well, what is he saying? Like, he's got a bunch of dummies working for him. And, you know, I was about to give him this big speech about, hey, you know, like, okay, not everyone's a genius. I get that. But everyone has genius. And with the right kind of leadership, it can be used and grown. And then I realized as he's continuing to explain this, that he's not talking about that. He's like, yeah, I got to show up right as a leader, but so do the people on my team. And what I wanted to look into is, what are people doing who are showing up right, who are showing up big, and who are contributing fully and making a difference? And so this is really the talent side of the equation.
Love it. What are the key factors of impact players?
Well, you know, in some ways, there's one thing. And then from that one thing, it branches. But it really is how we deal with ambiguity and uncertainty. Like, if I really had to point it down to one thing, because what we found is that, and the essence of the research was, we went out to 170 managers across 9 organizations, and we asked them to identify 2 different people on their team for us to kind of study and analyze, both of whom were smart, both of whom were hardworking, and both of whom were capable, but one of whom was doing a fine job and the other was doing an amazing job, really bringing extraordinary value, you know, making a difference in the organization. And so what we're trying to understand is, what is that difference? And it's not intelligence and talent and capability. And what we found is what we came to call the ordinary contributor. They were people who were doing their job and following direction. Then they were goal-oriented and focused and carried their weight on teams. And they were absolutely stellar in ordinary times. But when things got messy, unclear, uncertain, ambiguous, when there was no clear playbook for how to do things, that's when the impact players in our study really excelled. And that's when they thought about things, handled things very differently than the ordinary contributor. And it was everything with how they dealt with messy problems. You know, while others are doing their job, they're doing the job that needs to be done. You know, when roles are unclear, while other people are waiting for direction, they're stepping up and taking the lead. You know, they're surfacing as leaders. You know, when unforeseen obstacles drop in the path, while other people are escalating upward, like, hey, boss, we have a problem, they're getting things across the finish line. They're saying, like, hey, boss, we have a problem. I'm on it. And here's what I need you to do to help me solve this problem. You know, when the targets are shifting, when, you know, you thought you were going for one thing, but that morphs and it changes and it evolves, you know, while other people are kind of sticking with it, they're adapting and evolving, like, okay, I get it. We've got a lower budget. Okay, we're reframing the product. Like, they're adapting easily. They're more like chameleons. And, you know, when the workload is really heavy, while other people are adding to that burden, looking for other people to bring relief, they're making work light for everyone. They're just taking hard work and making it as easy as possible, making it feel easy, making it feel joyful. And all of those are situations that are fraught with ambiguity. And kind of back to, like, Mark, the one thing is, the impact players tend to move toward that ambiguity, while other people tend to step away from it. If I had to, like, sum it up in one thing.
Yeah, I love that. When I take a look at the relationship between someone who's maybe leading a group and someone who is in a group that's being led, where would you place the responsibility on becoming an impact player? Because there are certainly some situations that I've run into, you've run into too, where the leader is so domineering, taking control of the wheel all the time, that the person in the driver's seat just sort of sits back and we don't get to really see their full potential. So, but also when people are given an opportunity to make a decision, they freeze. Sometimes they freeze. And so where does, you know, if it's a evolving type of relationship, where does it sit? Because I might be working for someone who's an absolute okay person, but I just don't feel I have the autonomy to make decisions, et cetera. But I'd love to hear your perspective on where does the responsibility for that sit? Does it sit with the leader or does it sit with the person who's being led?
Well, I think it sits with both. And if I had to put the onus on someone, I would put it on the leader. And, you know, kind of like multipliers and diminishers, I realize it's not like there are multipliers in the world and there are diminishers. There are multiplying approaches and diminishing approaches. Some people master constantly the diminishing. Some people master constantly the multiplying. You know, I think there are some people who are just impact players. This is how they work. It's how they're going to work. And it doesn't matter who's their boss, who's their coach. Maybe they're the Kobe Bryants of the world who are like, you know what? I don't care who my coach is. I'm showing up. I'm playing big and I'm going to help the rest of the team do this. And, you know, it doesn't matter if they're playing for Coach K, getting ready for the Olympic Redeem team, or if it was their, you know, high school coach who maybe was a little bit less skillful. It's who they are.
Right.
There are probably some people who are going to struggle to work this way, regardless of who they work for. And I would venture to say that maybe somewhere early on in their life or their work life, they had adults, leaders, coaches who taught them, like, you know what, just play small, stay in your place.
Right.
Like somehow they developed a fear of hard things and challenge. And with all the right leadership, they might not respond well, but the bulk of people are heavily influenced by the kind of leadership they receive. And maybe to put it simply, as the level of diminishing and accidental diminishing goes down in an organization, the level of impact player behavior and mindset is going to go up. And so the leader is going to make or break that middle group, that bulk of people. But the onus isn't entirely on the leader. It's, you know, the leader's job is to sort of set that table, but then the contributor has to like show up. So I feel like it's which side of that equation needs to be worked at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's like if there's 100%, I think it's a sliding, you know, it could be 50-50 at one point, but the leader, if they take 75, you know, they're only going to get 20, you know, if they're 75%, the leaders, it's the, you know, they're overwhelming and everything, the person's only going to be 25%. So I think it's a slight, like you said, the amount of diminishing and multiplying it and impacting, I think they're deeply connected to one another.
They are. And I guess what I would encourage is a little bit of planned delusion on this is, are you delusional if you know you're delusional? No, if I were talking to leaders or if I was a leader on a team, I would assume that I am more than 50% of that. Like I own the bulk of that. If I were a member of that team or if I'm talking to members of the team, I would tell them they were more than 50% of it. And, you know, it's probably like, I think Brené Brown said this well about like marriage isn't 50-50. Like for each person in the marriage needs to assume that they're more than 50. They're going to give more than 50%. And I think like if each party assumes that they have the greater responsibility, it works. It works. And what it means is like, if you're a member of a team, it means that you have to remind yourself that you are not a victim of poor leadership, that you have the ability to influence how you work, how you show up, how big you play, how much of a lead you take. And it's great if you've got a boss that makes that easy, but if you have a boss that makes it hard, it doesn't mean it's impossible. It just means that you need to take a little more of that onus on you.
Yeah. Oh, 100% agree with that. And with all the opportunities that exist today, and with the shift, you know, during the Great Resignation, you know, there's so many opportunities to find a place where, you know, purpose is really being, you know, extended and people can connect to that purpose. And so it is on the onus. You know, a lot of times I think pre-COVID, people stayed with a job because, hey, I got a job. And, you know, they were, someone made a lot of money, term quiet quitting. Those were the, those were just the mildly disengaged. But, you know, there's so many opportunities right now to be able to look at different job opportunities. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you think, you know, we talk about COVID, and COVID is just a representation of a new world that we live in today. I want you to share with us, you know, in 2024, what should leaders be looking at? I mean, there's this hybrid remote work, there's AI. What are you seeing this upcoming year?
Well, I think disconnection is the thing to look at. You know, how do we rebuild communities? I mean, obviously AI is a really important issue. I'm not sure I have anything to offer there on how to AI-proof, AI-enable your organizations. But disconnection is, I think, an issue that most managers need to deal with coming out of the pandemic, inherent, you know, in the remote work model. But as things like move fast, I think it's so easy for people to feel like I'm disconnected. And maybe this is where AI comes in, is like, okay, now I'm like, the world is racing ahead of me and I don't know how to keep up. I don't know how to participate. I don't know how to know what's real. Like there's some, not deludedness, but some delusionment of like, I don't know how to engage. And I think a lot of people are opting just to stay disengaged. And, you know, we're finding, despite all of the efforts to affect the way we lead and affect our workplaces, is that disengagement continues to be on the rise, that more and more people are disengaged, and it's good for no one. And if I can risk sounding like, I think maybe I'm a little bit too young to be an old codger officially, but if I can channel a little bit of old codger, is I think there is a generational tendency right now to say, you know what, let me minimize work and I'm just going to like disengage, and work will be like a thing. I do as little of it as possible. I get through it, but that's not who I am. And to like have a very arm's length, distant relationship with work. And I think going down the disengagement path, like the planned disengagement path, is dangerous. I think it's dangerous for our economy, but I think it's really dangerous for people's mental health, emotional health. Like sometimes people think they're doing it for that, but it's not only like work is where we not only get our paychecks, it's, I don't know, it's where we necessarily get our meaning from, but it is where we get challenge from and a sense of satisfaction of completion. And it's an important part of community. And I think managers can help people not lose that sense of community of like, you know what, here's a bunch of people, we're working together to get something hard done. Like when we lose that, I don't think it's good for anyone.
Oh, 100% agree. Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we're looking at is people are staying with an old organizational framework, an old decision-making matrix, you know, of like, hey, this is a hierarchy, more decisions made at the top, I have to know all the answers. And look at, I believe this, I know you do too, I believe everyone's born with wanting to belong to something bigger than themselves. Just think it's inherently inside of us. But when we are burned out, there's not much that can, you know, overcome that. You know, and I think a lot of the friction that's happening, I always say it's like your car's out of alignment and your tires are wearing and you can continue to replace the tires, but like you can continue to replace the employees that leave. But if you don't get an alignment, same thing's going to happen. And so I think it's as the speed of business like continues to accelerate, and the complexity of decisions is up 65% over the last 3 years. So many variables to take a hold of, and people are just frozen. Like, mm-hmm. and they don't have these basic decision making skills to naively or with naivete to take a next step, and then adjust and take a next step again. I think, you know, that burnout is really caused. So I love your disconnection, because you can have the best mission statement. You can be doing all these things. When people are burned out, they're going to check out. So,
yeah. Well, and I'm glad you brought up like the role that burnout plays in this, because we do burn out at greater rates when we disconnect from something. And it's a little counterintuitive, I believe, because it's so easy to assume that when you're experiencing burnout or people on your team are experiencing burnout, it's because people are working too hard. There's too much.
Yeah.
Like we're grinding. And so we're burnt out. And everything in my research points to something different, in that we don't tend to burn out because we have too much work. We tend to burn out because we're having too little impact.
Love it.
Yeah, meaning like we're working hard, but we're not connected to something. We're not seeing the results because, you know, there's a question I've been asking for a lot of years, and it's like, what is it like when you're overworked but underutilized? Meaning you're working hard, but like your brain's not engaged. No, but you're not doing hard problems. And people describe that as frustrating, unsatisfying, soul-sucking, all that. But then they describe it as frequently as draining, tiring, exhausting. Mm. So when we're underutilized, it's exhausting. When I ask people why that is, the answers are, well, because I'm like working hard and not seeing the results, or I'm not getting the satisfaction of a job well done, or that reward or praise, or kind of that yummy you get when you're like, your brain is working. And it's like a great workout where you're tired, but yet you're energized. Like I find the lack of exercise is exhausting, but a solid regimen of exercise is energizing. And I think work is the same way. And so I really am concerned when I see like people disconnecting, or I start to disconnect from things, that's when you're going to get burnout rather than that sense of, man, I'm working hard, but man, does it feel great. Good. And winning together with other people. So like, don't check out, like kind of lean in is I think the thing that managers need to help people do right now.
Yeah. Love that. Love the connection, because you know, there's nothing better than, you know, waking up with a sense of purpose and going to work and then laying down at the end of the day going, phew, yeah, that was challenging, but you know what? I cannot wait until tomorrow.
You know, and I think, Mark, that sense of purpose doesn't need to be, you know, saving the world. I mentioned that, you know, I had this daughter who was working at Neuralink, and, you know, they really are changing the world. They've just had their first successful implant. And
oh, wow.
And I compared it to like my early days at Oracle, where I don't think we were saving the world. We were building a relational database management system that was going to build the backbone for the internet and the information age. So like we were building some cool technology, but it wasn't that kind of mission where I'm like, I tell people what I do and they're like, wow.
Yeah.
Like you're making a difference in the world. I don't know that you have to be doing something that is that kind of mission-driven, change the world, improve the world work to feel like you're really making a difference on a team and that you're doing something that's meaningful. Because just doing honorable work with honorable people is its own form of reward.
Yeah.
Like you can make a difference wherever you are and with whatever organization you're in is, I think, what I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love they don't know if this is true or not, but the story of President Johnson going to the Space Center in 1967, asking everyone what they did. you know, and obviously putting a man on the moon was important, but, you know, it goes around to two or three different people and they're like, oh, I'm in flight control and I'm, you know, part of the fuel storage. And then he goes to someone and says, what are you doing? He says, I'm putting a man on the moon. And he goes, no, what do you do here? And he's like, I'm the janitor. Mm-hmm. And it's like that connection to impacting another human being. And you could even take what Oracle did and just say, hey, think of all the connections that were made because of it. And think of all the data that was being able, the knowledge sharing and all that stuff. And so there is a way to make that connection. But like you said, it doesn't have to be this, you know, like what your daughter's doing is, yeah, wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be inherently noble work for you to feel like you're doing something that has some noble purpose.
Right. Yeah. 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 Fantastic. All right. So one of the things that I saw and I took the test. So if people want to do this, you can go to Liz's site, but you can see whether you are a diminisher or whether you are a multiplier. And Liz, I got a score of 27. Yes. So I'm right in the middle. But if you want to be able to do that, it's a powerful thing that you can go to Liz's site. And we'll put the link down below so people have access to your contact information and your site.
Yeah. And Mark, on that quiz, I think it's called Are You an Accidental Diminisher? It's not too bad to have a medium to high score on that. And here's why, because it's a self-assessment. And I've had so many people say, oh, I took your quiz and I'm not a diminisher. I'm like, okay, you mean the self-assessment quiz? Because we do have a 360 quiz, which our assessment, which will really tell you that. And they're like, yeah, like the little quiz, self-assessment. I'm like, okay, well, that tells you is you don't believe you're a diminisher. But, you know, when you actually see the things you're doing that could be having a diminishing effect, what that does is allows you to prevent that turning into a diminishing dynamic on your team. So don't be afraid if you've got a high score. What that means is you can see where the problems are.
Oh, I love self-reflection. And I'll keep self-reflecting until I leave this earth. What are you working on next? What's the next big thing for Liz Wiseman?
Oh, I got a new research project and a new book that will be in the works. It's not in the works today. There's no writing happening yet, but my colleague Lauren Hancock and I are looking at some of the formative experiences that really shape our mindsets and beliefs throughout our work life. Like, where does that come from? And the influence of somebody's first boss and some of those other formative experiences.
Yeah. Wow. That's going to be fantastic. You think about, because I think about my transformative experiences. I was blessed to have a mom and dad that, you know, gave me a lot of great tools. And then the Navy just kept fortifying, which was just really, really awesome. All right. So if someone's listening right now, we just had a great conversation. It was really fantastic. But what's like one thing that you would recommend for people to surface the leader inside of themselves?
Well, I think a healthy way to view leadership is, you know, not as a position, but as an act of service. And, you know, acts of service come and go. You know, there are times where you inconvenience yourself to go and serve a person, an organization, and then you tend to kind of fall back from that and you go about your planned affairs. I think good leadership looks like that now. It's fluid. We find with the impact players of the work world, when there's a leadership vacuum, they step up and lead. Like when there's a bunch of people sitting around a table and someone needs to lead the conversation or get something going, they step up and they provide that leadership, but they don't need to stay the boss of that initiative or everything forever. Like they're not the kind of person who always needs to be the boss. They provide that leadership as an act of service. But when that service is rendered, then they fall back into their kind of normal position. And I think of it a lot like a flock of migrating geese, where there's not an alpha bird that leads that flock in that V formation, that like heroically takes the extra load of breaking through that wind and creating that, you know, aerodynamic kind of drag. It's a role that everyone plays. And, you know, the birds rotate between this, and it allows the flock to fly 71% further than a single bird could fly, you know, in a solo migrating pattern. And I think this is what good leadership looks like. It's you step up and you lead, but then you step back and you let somebody else lead. And in many ways, like to kind of surface the leader in you, it's like we probably need to roll back to third grade when the leadership assignments rotated. Like, you know, there was a list on the board of who was like passed out the papers and who led people to recess and who brought the class back from recess. And we didn't just decide that, you know, Mark was the best leader in the class. Everyone took their turn. And when everyone takes their turn, no one person gets exhausted having to lead every conversation, every initiative, every meeting. And then you don't have the rest of the group that's underutilized because they never get a chance to flex that leadership. And so I think it's more like seeing leadership as a temporary act of service and less like a position you hold forever. And thank you for practicing that, Mark. Like that's, I can see that that's who you are and it's what you're out there helping other people to do.
Yeah. You know, where I learned it from was submarine force. We had 3 6-hour watches and we had to rotate the leader. And so when I was leading, when other people were off watch and there was a fire that broke out, I needed them to help me be successful. And I wanted them to do that. And they wanted to do that because when they started leading, when they were in the watch section and they were leading the watch and I was, they wanted me to help too. And it created this like tremendous bonds of like trust. And then we saw too, like, oh, wow, look at Liz ran it that way. I like that. I'm going to take that and have that be part of my toolkit. And this ability to lead, but then this tremendous ability to learn how to follow is so, so needed today. And I just love that we ended on that great note. That was fantastic. Yeah. You know, when I think about Liz, you know, your journey and what you're doing, you know, I'm so appreciative that you were, you know, on the Service and Leaders podcast. Definitely want to stay connected. You know, when I think about the, what are 3 words, you know, your naivete, I think is so needed today to be able just to take some type of next step, knowing your next decision is not your final decision. The ability to, you know, have that naivete to navigate this dynamically changing world and also to put people in natural positions. So it's like N plus, 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 like those things, naivete, ability to navigate the world and put others in naturally positions that they can be successful. I think there's so much that we learned today. And again, thank you for being on the Servicing Leaders podcast.
It's my pleasure. It was a great conversation with you, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks for joining Mark today. And remember, new episodes of Servicing Leaders will be available every other week where you can become inspired, gain confidence, and learn leadership right where you are. Until next time, make it a great day.